The Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, Pre-Existence.
Now we were talking about Clement's questions. Remember the first thing he wanted, and this is very relevant to what we're doing. The first question he does not want to die and go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot. That's a future he does not relish. It bothers him, he says, whether he liked it or not. Since he was a small child, it was after him all the time, this idea. So that was the first question he asked, would he live hereafter? And he went to all the doctors of the schools in Rome, and there were lots of schools in Rome, and the answers he's got, well, yes, you'll live in the trees and the flowers, or you'll live in memory, or you'll be absorbed into the great sea of being. And he didn't find that satisfactory at all. He wanted something literal. So we went to the subject of literalism. And then we saw that then he went and talked with Peter, and Peter said, yes, this is absolutely literal. We absolutely deny, he says, that there is anything evil in matter. That's part of the picture. This was a revolutionary teaching. And then he goes farther. Well, then we saw that the early teachers of the church, the early Christians, all taught that, of course. They were literal-minded. The doctors of the schools weren't. By the 4th century, they'd got rid of that completely and would have nothing to do with matter. Matter was entirely evil. The Neoplatonic doctrine, you get to someone like Plotinus, and any contact with evil would defile even God himself. Well, from there, but he had the satisfaction of the early Christians, of the early doctors. They've got away from, and to this day, you see, the Christians believe in a non-literal conception of things. Well, if he was to exist, then the idea of his existence being a real thing, and as an individual, this was important to be himself, then it must have been a pre-existence. It must be an ongoing. If he is a spiritual, eternal being, he must have existed before, and part of the picture, thing that bothered him as much as anything, was this idea of pre-existence. And we were just seeing the last time, that pre-existence was also an important part of the picture. They got all these references here, just to refer to a couple of them here. Let's just start here. Just summarize it here. In that first volume of Migne, the first volume of the Patrologia, there is an interesting note by Migne himself, the editor. He speaks for the fathers of the church on this subject, and it's his comment on Clement, 1 Clement 1:28, where he says, Clement asserts that the spirit is older than the body, according to one of the four interpretations of the fathers. Now he says the fathers interpret this four ways. Did we exist, pre-exist or not? Remember, this is always all essential to our handbook of terrible questions, which is the Pearl of Great Price. The first thing he says, that Migne says, is one school taught that the spirit was before the body. It was pre-existent. A second, that it came after. The body came first and the spirit after that. Still others, that they came into existence together. That school has a special name. See it. And still others that are not willing to make any assertion at all. Along with which opinions should be mentioned the errors of the Pythagoreans, the Platonists, the Gnostics, and the Origenists. Notice he classes them, the Hermetic school. Origen, for a time, firmly believed in the pre-existence, and then he changed his mind. The Pythagoreans believed in reincarnation, in metempsychosis, that you did exist before, but it was in another shape of being, another animal or something, which is no satisfaction, since if you change your identity completely, you are somebody else, and you really haven't continued to exist. I may have been a chair in a pre-existence. That doesn't give me any satisfaction now. Or to think that I'll be a cockroach hereafter gives me no great comfort either. See, that is not me continuing. They feel that very strongly, this, the assertion. The Egyptians are particularly strong on this. The person, that's why this emphasis on the name. It was the name to help preserve his identity. It was himself and nobody else that continued. And it wasn't just life. Well, we mentioned that you had to have hereafter, but you had to preserve your identity as well. But the Platonists, Plato really believed that we existed before and what we have hereafter. We still have dim memories of that. the reason we have an idea of the good, the beautiful, and the true. How do you know it's good, beautiful, and true? Because you saw it before. You have a memory of it when you come here. And every recognition of truth is a recognition of something you knew and you learned before, and we're moving toward that state. Plato went all the way there. And the organist, I said, he changed place. Well, now Oregon said this was the teaching of the venerated elders, the earliest Christians, the brethren in the early church. But he has equal respect for the doctors of the schools, because he was born and raised, actually, on the campus of the University of Alexandria. His father was teaching, and he was born there. And he could never get that out of his system, so he's perplexed. He doesn't know what to do. So he began by fervidly preaching the doctrine of preexistence and ending up by denying it. But in the 6th century, it flared up again in his name, the organist, in Palestine, among the monasteries there and in Egypt, too. And it had a revival at that time as the true teachings of the church. Well, the... But when you get to Hilary in the West, in the 4th century, he says preexistence stumps him completely. It is an impious and an alien study. You should not study, you should not even think about it. Because he says, how can anything exist before it is born? How is that possible? They're giving rational answers, you know, not scriptural ones. Or in that case, why bother? He said, but he did bother. He couldn't leave it alone. In many places, St. Augustine accepts the doctrine, apparently because of the appeal of Plato, Anamnesis. He believed it up until the year 410 A.D. Would you say that was a crisis year? And after 410, he didn't believe it. After that, we're quoting a study by Lucia here. After that, he hesitates and does not cease to hesitate between productionism and creationism. Productionism is the doctrine that the spirit and the body were created at the same moment. Creationism, that they were created separately, they belonged to separate creations and were then joined together. But traductio means carried over together. Incidentally, we have to do something to make this more photogenic. I'm going to bring a visual display the next time. Oh, it will stagger you this time. Some bigger, it will be a book, in fact. But a most unusual book. And so he hesitates between productionism and creationism, though he preferred the latter because it explained the transmission of the original sin. He repeats endlessly, says this writer, that he has not yet made up his mind, which is thoroughly typical. He never made up his mind. This is interesting because this is the father. St. Augustine is the maker of Western theology. I mean, the Protestants are as dependent on Augustine as the Catholics. But he never made up his mind. His mother wouldn't let him, for one thing. Remember, he was a very pious and very moral young man, but his mother wouldn't let him marry the mother of his illegitimate child. He had a child, Deus Dedit, whom he's very devoted, but his mother said, no, you'll ruin your career chances. This was Santa Monica was the mother of Augustine, and she wouldn't let him get married. She'd say, modo, put it off, don't get married yet, because when you've had your pleasure and all your fun and that, then will be the time that you can repent and get forgiven and carry on. Meantime, don't let a family interfere with your career. And he tells us quite frankly that the objection to sex was not sex at all. It was the danger of having children, having a family. Sex was okay if you didn't have a family. This is the great St. Augustine. Because he says, when you think of having squalling children and the smell of cooking cabbage and having to change diapers and shrieking wives in the house, the short patients and so forth, you have to be free to concentrate every thought on God. Think always on God and nothing else. Adhaereo Deo was his slogan. You see, you must cling to God regardless of what and keep him constantly in mind. It's what the Arabs call fatra, nothing but God. And in that case, you can't bother about marriage. See, marriage is a distraction. It's marriage that's bad, not letting off steam once in a while. He felt that was all right, and he did. When he was 70 years old, he tells us in the Confessions that this was his daily prayer. God, give me chastity and continence, but not yet. Sed non modo. Give me chastity and continence. Sed non modo. Let me wait a while. In other words, he wanted to have his cake and eat it. This was the purpose of rhetoric. This was the whole spirit of the times he lived in, the 4th and 5th century. And he was amazed when he saw the whole civilization collapse before his eyes. Couldn't understand why it was so. But I think he may have contributed as much as anyone. Well, and he believes in the pre-existence, perhaps following Cicero, he says in Apuleius. But in AD 394, he first rejected the idea, popular with the Gnostics, that the soul sinned in the pre-existence. That's the other one. See, we're here to being punished because we've sinned before we could. He gave that up first, and then he gave up pre-existence entirely. But he didn't condemn the hypothesis of pre-existence itself that time. Well, in short, says this particular study, Augustine truly does not know. It is perhaps temerity to want to penetrate a mystery reserved to God himself, he says. And then there was an official statement by the church. There was a synod held in Africa in 523 by a number of bishops. Well, they were in exile from Sardinia, actually. And they sent a synodal epistle around stating, this is the answer to the question. The question we should either leave in silence or consider without contention, since the Holy Scripture gives no clear statement. There's the idea. See, many precious things had been removed. See, this is one thing to which the schools are very, very much opposed. In other words, they turned Plato right around. The Neoplatonists got rid of that part of Plato's teaching. They didn't like that at all. And we say these things have been removed and removed from the scriptures. So they're able to tell us in a council in Sardinia in 523, they quote, the question we should either leave in silence or consider without contention, since the Holy Scriptures give no clear statement. It should be investigated with caution, especially since it's possible for the faithful to ignore it without disadvantage, detrimental. Incidentally, when we quote these councils of the church, and there have been many, 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 we have the original records and notes, printed, of course, edited by Nisa, and we have two editors, the great Mansi. We have the complete Mansi here. Now, Mansi is a complete record of all the councils of the churches are held, the Greek and Latin and everything. What was said, who presided at the meeting, what was done, I say, for these times we have remarkably full records. You know what? Everything that went on in the church at that time. Bishops that were questioned, troubles that came up in wards and so forth, and they go into tens of thousands of pages. We have them all over here under the connection of Mansi. And if you want to read the abbreviated, edited version, though it is many volumes, that's the Hefele. Professor Jaeger, supposed to be the best classical scholar of his time, he told me, he said, I always read my Mansi in Hefele. He never bothered to go to Mansi itself. Hefele was easier to manage. But you can go to Hefele, that's an E, or you can go to Mansi. In other words, if you're interested in any council of the church, you can find out all about it there. They're chronologically arranged, and they take place at different places and so forth, and you find some most interesting things going on. In fact, years ago, I made a rundown of every one of them. I have a pile of pages. It's quite exciting, really. But never had any use for them, alas. Well, sometimes, yes. But this is a good example. Yet we know that this teaching, actually, when they tell us, well, it can be ignored without disadvantage. You don't have to worry about the pre-existence necessarily. But it's a teaching that had enormous impact. We know that. It makes all the difference on how we look at our situation upon earth, doesn't it? And Brigham Young said that more Latter-day Saints apostatize because of the doctrine of pre-existence than for any other reason. It drove, this is, comes as a surprise to show how completely it has been wiped out of the Christian consciousness, that more than polygamy, more than the trials and hardships, more than the teaching of the law of consecration, things that a lot of people didn't like and so forth, what turned more people off was this very rational doctrine of pre-existence, which is being accepted much more widely. The churches are taking a hard second look at it now because it's very essential to understanding our situation. But it was not in the cards in the 19th century. And this is an interesting thing. Back to our old friend Augustine again. You see, we have all the works of Augustine, and there are a lot of them, and they're enormously influential. Remember, Luther himself was an Austin friar. He was an Augustinian. It was the doctrine of anamnesis, the intimations of immortality, that are supposed to have moved Augustine, who first accepted it all the way and then finally rejected it, as I said. In his book of Retractions, 1, 8, and 2, he says, because such a doctrine requires a pre-existence, the trouble is, he says, it does not agree with science. Notice, not the scriptures. He has no objection to the scriptures. But it doesn't agree with science, so we can't. Science does not prove the pre-existence. As a matter of fact, it doesn't. and it takes something to prove the pre-existence. But that's why St. Augustine rejected it. That's the sort of thing you can only know by revelation and intuition, I suppose. He does not, as Father Eggersdorfer says, in a very good study, he does not reject it on scriptural or religious grounds, but only because he finds it illogical. He says it's not a scientific doctrine. On the contrary, what bothers him is that the scriptures keep bringing it up. If Revelations 4 and 6 talks about familiar animals found around the throne of God, he says in his epistle number 124, incidentally, we have 195 letters of St. Augustine. This is an interesting thing about Augustine. Remember, he lived the 4th through 420, between the centuries there, and he was the most important man in the church, and he was the Bishop of Hippo, and everybody sends letters to him asking questions, and we have the answers he gave to these questions. And the funny thing is, they ask him basic questions of doctrine and marriage and things like that. He never refers them to any higher authority. He doesn't say go to Rome or go to Milan or go to the head of the church. He knows no head of the church to go to at that time. There was no uniform church. Of course, the Roman church claims him as their own. Everybody else does, but St. Augustine didn't know of that clearinghouse. He doesn't say take your troubles, take your doctrines to a higher source. Never once refers them to a higher source. A very interesting thing. And very often he says, I can't answer your letters and there's nothing we can do about it. The question stumps me. Well, and then Jerome, his friend, Jerome, who was living in the East and who was responsible, remember, Jerome gave us the Vulgate, the Latin Bible, which is the most important Bible, the official Bible of the Roman Catholic Church, and the one which was used more in translating the King James than any other because they had it. Luther stayed close to it. And Paul, well, he cites the example along with John Chrysostom, that Paul knew everything that existed before this world, but it cannot be uttered. What is harder than to find out what the beginning or the end of a thing is? Moses knew, and so did Solomon, says Chrysostom, who says, I shall remember the things from the beginning of the world, Apionis, but they don't tell us what it is. In the end, Augustine dismisses it with a one-liner, a very famous one-liner that Luther uses about the pre-existence, he says. It's a nervous and unsatisfactory solution. What was God doing before the creation, he says? Making a hell for people who ask that question. Too many questions, he says. His own solution. Then he adds his own solution in the Confessions 11 and 12, Nescio quod Nescio. I don't know because I don't know. Well, there we have to leave it here. And again here, Bossuet, the great Catholic preacher, says Clement of Alexandria expressly rejected the old doctrine of pre-existence. No, he says the old doctrine of pre-existence. It was the older one. Clement of Alexandria, who comes very early, see, 3rd century, expressly rejected the old doctrine of pre-existence because it conflicted not with the scriptures, but with Greek philosophy and culture. Everything must be tested by Aristotle, by the schools, as far as that goes, later on by Aristotle, not. You do not change the doctrine to agree with the scriptures, you change the scriptures to agree with Plato. This was done all the time. If you had a conflict between Plato and the scriptures were always adapted. There was this constant accommodation. The scriptures were, that's why they were able to get along with the schoolmen and the advancement of science as they understood it, namely, they accommodated the scriptures as they went. They did not accommodate the new philosophy to the scriptures, but the other way around. It shows which was the real authority. And it was the, not with the scriptures, but the Greek philosophy and culture. And Alexander Clement mocks the old-fashioned orthodoxasti, he calls the old orthodoxers, and their fear of the higher culture and new advanced education. They were afraid of that. In other words, they're fundamentalists. They want to be fundamentalists, and he says, we can't change that. They're foolish for being afraid of that. The final decision was not with Plato, though, and the Stoics, but with Aristotle. And here we're quoting a new study by Florovsky on this subject in the text in Aristotle on this. God has given independent being, now this is Aristotle, God has given independent being and life neither to the nature of souls itself nor to the nature of bodies separately, but rather to men composed of soul and body. They cannot be separated. The soul and body cannot exist apart. You cannot have had a pre-existence. Well, what happens after you die then? And what happens? Well, I guess you pretty near to Seventh-day Adventist doctrine, aren't you? They teach soul sleep. You go to sleep. You become completely unconscious until the resurrection. The soul has no awareness, no consciousness. In other words, to say, no existence. In other words, there's no time. So what's the value of it? What have you gained by that? You start up where you ended and continue right on. Soul sleep is a completely pointless doctrine. Again, it's like your odorless perfume. You cease to exist, but you cease to be aware of the fact that you're not existing, and then all of a sudden, there you are, and so that's that. It might have been a million years, it might have been 10 minutes. Who cares? It makes no difference. You just weren't there. Well, this is some doctrine. I mean, I don't know how I can build great faith on that. Severus says, not Septimius Severus, but this Severus of Antioch says, in the fashioning of man, the rational soul is not created before the body, nor the body before the soul. And so it goes. Cyril and Basil and Well. Lactantius, the first Latin father, mocks the doctrine of preexistence as a Stoic and Pythagorean doctrine. and, oh, wonderful and singular Pythagorean memory, he says, he's being very caustic here, of another life. Oh, miserable us in our total oblivion. Why don't we know that we lived before? He asks. Well, it is also, Philastrius says, it is also, very early writing it, it is also heresy to say that before the body of man was created, there was no spirit. It's a heresy to say that the spirit was created before the body, but it is also heresy to say that before the body, there was no spirit. Well, now what are you going to do about that? And that man is in the image of God's body and not the spirit of man. When the prophet says God said, let us make man, it was future, as a making not of flesh, but of the spirit, which he declared to be rational. And the male and female has nothing to do with the sex of corporeal matters, but of the rule of the spirit. And so it goes on and on and on. Well, your own problem. He says the most amazing things. Jerome says, if we accept that doctrine, it will destroy the whole allegorical value of the scripture, which is that these things happen spiritually, not physically. What Oregon said was foolish and so forth. Against Oregon, again, the angels have their degrees not by merit but by creation. The angels had no pre-existence either. It is a depraved and wicked Gentile error. This is our friend Jerome saying, it is a depraved and wicked Gentile error when Oregon says the spirit of man partakes of the nature of divinity. Well, now, anything which is eternal, you know, the definition of what is divine is what's eternal. The eternal is divine, the divine is eternal, and anything else, it covers everything beautifully, if you think of it. But he says it's a depraved and wicked Gentile error when Oregon says the spirit of man partakes of the nature of divinity. There's nothing in it. As if the maker and the made could be of the same nature. As if they could have anything at all in common. It is utterly vicious to make God in any way like man. So how are you going to discuss God or say anything about him? And I say, then Jerome is going to tell you all about what God is like. He's after saying you can't possibly define him. Chrysostom does the same. But a statement like that is utterly vicious to make God in any way like man. If that were so, then upon becoming incorruptible, there's only one conclusion to be drawn. They would become as gods, who were not so before. And that amounts to making created things resemble God. Now, such were the absolutes of the 4th century schools. No created thing can resemble God. No, you deal in absolutes all the way. And when you have an absolute, there's no argument at all. As Copernicus says, inter finitum et infinitum, known as proportio. There is no proportion between the infinite and the finite. There's nothing you can say they have in common. There's nothing you can say about one that will apply to the other. So forget about it. Well, you'd think this would put an end to thought, ring down the curtain, and give us a few years of peace. Don't believe it for a minute. Just the sort of thing the philosophers love to feed on. Heavens, you can hold endless committee meetings on a subject like this. You never stop, and they never did. They have these hundreds of councils, and they fight like cats and dogs, and they go round and round, and it keeps them from becoming bored, like the academic feuds of the universities, ancient and modern. They start these feuds going, they go for hundreds of years, and they're the only thing that makes life interesting. And for some people, unbearable, the famous, what's his name, wrote a very good essay on that subject, you know, who wrote who wrote The Life of Queen Victoria and so forth. It was the famous argument between Dr. Arnold and Dr. Bentley at Oxford. It ranged for almost a century. you took out Dr. Bentley's side, or you took the other side, and I know his name is quite well. Again, here we go. Who wrote that? His name sounds like Listy or something like that. I'll come back in a second. Well, his main argument is against the idea that Adam and Eve came down and took bodies as punishment, a favorite Gnostic and Origenistic idea. We don't go with that either, as far as that goes. Well, all right, let's get it official now. 593, the first canon of the Fifth General Council of the Church, in the year 593, made this statement, which Christians stick to this day. And it's issue number 204. They'd argued 203 problems for days and days before they got to this one. It was just like a state legislature, any other legislature. If anyone says or holds that the psyche of the Lord existed before and was united with God before his incarnation from the Virgin and his earthly birth, let him be anathema. He'll be cursed if he claims that even the Lord, even Christ, existed before he came down and was born to the Virgin. Now, isn't that a statement? I was with the Father, I left him, he says, I came down, he left his glory and so forth. The glory I had with thee before the world was, and so forth. All that counts for nothing here. It's the doctrines of the schools that count. Anyone holds that the psyche, that's the soul of the Lord, existed before and was united with God before his incarnation from the Virgin and his earthly birth, let him be anathema. That you'll find in Denzinger. Incidentally, there's a very convenient source some of you might be interested in, and that's Denzinger. This is the official statement of all, as it stands at present, of all the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church. Denzinger. Look it up in your Denzinger, and you'll find it. And this is in Denzinger versus Oregon, 593, number 204. Yes, they're in that order. Now, and Father Danielu, the last person to treat this, he died recently under very strange circumstances. Excuse me. He was a cardinal and a very able man, and he saw all these points. He saw very clearly the weakness of the position that the Christian churches take today, how weak they are in ignoring these things and passing them by and so forth. He says the weak point in Origen's theory is thus his idea that there is more than one existence. What? No afterlife? He cites Canon 1 of the Fifth General Council. If anyone teaches the mythical doctrine, this is the same council we're talking about, 593, that's the key date. If anyone teaches the mythical doctrine of the pre-existence of the soul and the apoptosis, that is return after this life, we return to our Father in heaven that they may again return into our presence and receive everlasting life. If anyone teaches that, because they were teaching it, because of mythical doctrine and the apocatastasis that follows from it, let him be anathema. Anathema. Wiped out of the books, not considered, cursed, and so forth. Well, here's an interesting thing here, just in the last note on this thing. Methodius, a person who enjoys great prestige among the doctrinalists, he says Plato and Origen were all wrong because it is against nature, scientific, logical action. If you had to figure out these things rationally, of course, we'd never arrive to them. It is against nature for a soul to exist without a body or a body without a spirit. You have to have them both. In other words, they don't believe in spirits, is what he's talking about when he says it's against nature for a soul to exist without a body or a body without a spirit. And though in this treatise he treats the resurrection from every angle, he treats it from Jonah and Moses and Elijah on the mountain and so forth, every instance, but he never once makes reference to the resurrection of the Lord. Isn't that something? The resurrection, the appearance of Christ after his resurrection during the 40 days. That's in Methodius, the 18th volume of the Patrologian, if any of you are burning with curiosity. So the preexistence of man. Well, this goes on and on and on. Mentioned it. So, now, so the early church believed in it, the later churches and the official churches today do not believe in it. And that's that. But we do. It's restored by Joseph Smith. And Incidentally, the most beautiful description of this and the most moving is the oldest, the very oldest. I decided it wouldn't be a waste of time. I brought the text here, but in order to stop hemming and stalling around, because I'm not exactly on my toes in this particular Syriac, is something I haven't been in for a long time. So I'm going to use this, the text. Five different people have made translations beside me, so all I can do is pass the buck to them. Here. And I compare their various translations and all this, make it look very careful. But this is this thing called the Pearl. Now, it was found in 1906 by Rendell Harris, I say way up east of the Tigris there. And its dating is interesting because Alfred Adam, who is a Catholic scholar who lives in Palestine, in Jerusalem, a very able Orientalist, he dates it between 50 and 70 A.D. That means it could have been written within 20 years of the crucifixion. 25 years at the most. That brings it right down. Could have been. But it is Walter Krum, who is the great authority on Coptic documents, this too, places it right there in the first century. So we're right back before 100. You can't get an older document than this. It's a Christian doctrine. And it is called the Pearl. And it is meant to be a romanticized thesis, something like stories we write in the, we used to have a story added upon. Now we put rather mediocre, that's a flattering word, musicals about pre-existence and things like My Time on Earth and all this sort of thing. You sentimentalize it. I don't know how much the author of The Pearl cleared on this, but it is the oldest Christian hymn we have, and it is certainly the most remarkable. And it starts out, Kadanach Shabar Yalud, in my first primeval childhood. He's in heaven, you see, before he came here. I was nurtured, quoting Elijah R. Snow, as you recognize here. the very words, you see. I was nurtured in the royal house of my father with loving care in the midst of abundance and glory. This is where he came from, you see. My parents sent me forth from our home in the east, the source of light supplied with all necessities. So he has to come down, and we'll see why. And the idea is the pearl. He has to get the pearl and bring it back with him. And the pearl is the integrity which he preserves during the trials and tests of this life, so he can continue hereafter to be a member of the royal family and assume his throne and crown above. Making a packet for me from our rich storehouse. It was sizable, but light enough for me to carry. It came from the house on high as a great treasure. I had with bringing with me precious stones from India and Kushan and gold and silver, and they girt me with a diamond. Now this diamond, you asked about Adamus, didn't you? There's an interesting footnote on Adamus, on the diamond here. Were you aware of that? Good, then we won't bother about it. Now because the word Adam was associated with the name diamond, adamantus. You see, adamantus, our word diamond, means that which cannot be damaged, that which is immortal, that which can't... Damage, our word damage is to damage. A Greek primitive makes it negative. Adamantus means it can't be damaged. And there's a long story behind that. But the diamond is the Urim and Thummim, the sacred stone that Adam had that was given to him when he came down. It was so the name Adamantus given to him, the prince of stones and so forth. Well, this is a long thing anyway. But they removed me from me the garment of light which they made for me above. Now, the idea is that when you were above, when you were up above, you lived in heavenly, you had a heavenly garment, and when you left, you came down here, and it was put aside, carefully folded and laid under the throne to be kept there, under your father's throne, to be kept there when you came back, if you would be worthy to receive it again. And a good deal is said in this Syriac stuff, for example, about the great tragedy of falling or sinning in this life, because you lose all that you invested in. What you have up there represents long terms of investment and work to achieve such a state, and you left it all there on reserve in deposit, the crown and the garment carefully folded, deposited in the throne, some say in a special chest, for you to resume when you return. And if you can't take it back again, you've lost all that you worked for before, which makes this trial, this earthly trial, a very important one, a key experience, a terrifying sort of thing, if we miss it. See, you can miss it, and it's so important not to. And so they removed from me the garment of light, which they'd made from me, the garment of ore, and my purple robe made exactly to fit me, and it would fit no one else. This is the interesting, it is your robe, and it has certain marks on it, and so forth. They made a covenant with me, and wrote it in my heart, lest I go astray. So you've covenanted with your parents about it, in this test, you see. So he's instructed to go down to Egypt and bring back the pearl, its integrity. And it's in the sea, guarded or surrounded by a fire or poisonous snorting serpent, the dragon, which is, as Henneke puts it, this was the dragon, the serpent of the Garden of Eden, guarding this thing, but he has to get it away from him. He has to outwit the dragon and get the pearl as a serpent. Returning the pearl, he may resume his garment of light and his outer priestly mantle and become heir to our kingdom along with our second one. The second one is the second one, second heir to the throne. He'll become heir along with the son. That's what he's talking about here. As the second one is not the second born, it says, but the next or second in line to the throne, as Hoffman says, second in glory, successor. That is the firstborn, Christ the elder brother. So if you perform properly when you go down there, you can come back and resume your place with resume his garment and become heir to our kingdom along with our second one. So when he comes down, he has two guides or guardians. Remember, you always go in threes here. They're official couriers who know the way and who are sent down with him up to the point where they bid him goodbye and he's on his own. Remember, the two guides say, we'll leave you now, but we'll return later. Then the minute Adam finds himself alone, that is the time Satan strikes and tries to win him over. And that's what happens here. The two guardians are sent with him. That's standard, as you know, in the 18th chapter of Genesis and so forth. The Lord appears with the three men, appear always the three. He arrived at Mishan, where the merchants of the East gathered. Mishan is the dividing line, you see, where the goods are all transshipped and everything, like the upper cataract, the second cataract on the Nile, where all the goods of Central Africa are transshipped to go into Egypt. And it's a new world, a new state. In fact, at the cataract, Senusret III, way back 2000 BC, set up a famous monument which still stands. Says, this is the line. The people to the south of this may not go north of this line. This is the line. The others may not go south, but this is the boundary. And when you pass this line, when you pass this stela, you enter another world. Senesus the Third's famous inscription. It's the same sort of thing. That's what Mishan is. The place of transition between the worlds. Well, and on the other side, he's in Babel. Now he's in Babylon. Now he's in this world, which of course is called Babylon. And enters the walls of Sarbuk, and of course it's been suggested that that's one of the Sumerian cities, Sarbuk Surapak, one of the oldest cities in the world, one of the three oldest supposedly cities of the world, along with Erech, is Surapak, and that's the Sarbuk he's talking about. This would certainly apply. This was a very ancient story, wouldn't it? But Sarbuk didn't exist anymore this time. The ancient Mesopotamian city of Surapak, early noted by scholars, but the identity was rejected on geographical grounds. Well, there the guides leave him on his own, and he goes on toward Egypt. And as in the book of Tobit here, Egypt means the spiritual Sodom he's going to and Gomorrah. In Egypt, he immediately looks up the serpent. He's got to find the serpent who has the... It's quite homey. It's quite like a novel. Who has the pearl, and the serpent is staying at a hotel. There's an inn there. And he goes to the inn, and he checks in at the inn, too. He has a room. He's going to keep an eye on the serpent here. Finds him at the inn. So he also puts up at the inn in order to catch the dragon while he's still asleep. See, this could be made into a spy thriller, the dragon being just a figure, a label given to the odious person who is going to try to get the best of him, who does, as a matter of fact. He shouldn't be doing this dangerous thing the way he does. Don't try to go to the dragon with the inn. You'll be in trouble in order to catch him asleep. Well, there he meets a young nobleman from his own country who was born in the covenant, is going to help him, with whom he shares full confidence. He warns him against the temptations and defilements of Egypt. You're going into a dangerous country. I can help you out here. This is also a part of the spy thriller, isn't it? He meets up with Agent X or something like that, someone who has a special title, the fat man. Well, the fat man is on the sinister side, isn't he? But he meets up with somebody, and if you know your, well, whatever it is, who's writing the best spy thrillers now? I guess Le Carré, or That's what you do there anyway. And to avoid arousing suspicion, still like a spy thriller, as a stranger, he adopts the dress of the Egyptians, makes himself up like Egyptians. And he can't get away with it. He's not that clever about it. He gives himself away in speech and all sorts of things. He doesn't really belong to this world, as the saint does. See, this is a member of the church he's talking about, one who's accepted the covenant, finds himself in this position. And so his behavior is different, and they suspect something about him, that he's not really one of them. They notice that he's an alien, and so what do? They invite him in and make friends of him and ask him to enter some of their deals. They invite him to dinner, and the wine flows freely, and before you know, he's one of the boys, which is exactly where they wanted him. Whereupon, 34, he forgot that he was the son of the king and served their king. Well, they got him over to their side. Their plan of counter-espionage took him in just like that. And what's more, he enjoyed the life. The spies, the half dozen spies within the last few weeks that have gone over, that we've read about, such a shocking situation, they all did it for money. The same thing here. He liked the high lifestyle, and the rich foods dulled his senses, and he fell into a deep sleep. Ha ha, they put him out. Well, the poor guy's helpless now. So what's going to happen now? Meanwhile, 36. The heavenly parents are aware of what has happened. They call a family council up above. We've got to do something to save the boy. He's making a fool of himself. And all the great and noble relatives come together, and they decide it's time to act. They must do something. So they draft a letter, and they all sign it. This letter might stir him up. If this doesn't do any good, they'll have to do something else. But let's try sending him a letter. See if we get these things, too. I'm sure we've all slipped sometime or other, and then there's something, some reminder from home. It's addressed, quote, to our son in Egypt, from thy father, the king of kings, and thy mother, the queen of the east, to our second one, thy brother. And this was the letter. Awake and arise from thy sleep. Heed this letter. Remember that you are the son of a king, and take a good look at your present master. Remember your mission to fetch the pearl. Remember the garment and robe that are awaiting you, so you can put them on again when your name is called out from the book of those who were valiant. This is interesting, this valiant, because the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants you have that time. They were valiant and so forth. And you become heir to our... Well, you will come back and your name is called out from the book of those who were valiant, and you become the heir to our kingdom along with your brother, the successor to our throne. And we read in Doctrine and Covenants 76, these are they who receive his glory, but not of his fullness, who receive the presence of the Son, but not the fullness of the Father. You notice it says the same thing. And our second elder brother awakens, remember that you are the son of a king. Wherefore, they obtain not the crown over the kingdom of our God. Notice, these are they who are not valiant. Wherefore, they obtain not the crown over the kingdom of our God. Using the same imagery exactly that we're finding here in the pearl, which is an interesting thing we find in the 76th section. And 76th and 77th verses of the Doctrine and Covenants. Well, then the king with his right hand sealed the letter again. Notice there has to be revelation, there has to be authority here in these things. So he seals the letter. The sealing is very important in the early Christian writings, of course, with his seal. And against the evil children of Babylon and the rebellious spirits of Sarbud. Lest they open it and read it or destroy it, and something is sealed. It's protected. That's what the seal is. Keeping it out of contact with the world. Keeping it out of their hands. That's why we seal people up and seal things. So they won't reverse. If you seal a thing, you put a fix on it. Taha. See. Khatam is the regular word in Egyptian, Arabic, everything else. Khatam is a seal or the stamp you put on something that it can't be opened by anybody else. So the evil children of Babylon, rebellious spirits of Sarbuk. The letter was reached and brought by an eagle, the king of the birds. This is a very rich theme in the East. King Solomon sent a letter to the Queen of Sheba, Queen Bilkis, and it was carried by the eagle, the name heir, the sea eagle, who flew through her window while she was asleep and dropped it upon her bosom. She wrote and saw the seal of Solomon on it, and opened it and read it, and was duly impressed and so forth. But it was delivered by the eagle. And, of course, that eagle, as we know, is representative, stands for a revelation, a dream, a spirit, or something like that. It comes to them while they're asleep. See, the queen was asleep, and the naysayer flew through the window and dropped it on her breast, and she opened it and read it. See, it came to her in her sleep and knew that Solomon was approaching. The letter reaches him as an eagle, the king of the birds. It alights by his side and becomes all speech. See, the letter became all speech. Whereupon he wakes and rises from his sleep. He was sleeping, the same way the queen was. So this is what stirs him up again. So there is a contact with the other world. We do have contacts, you see. They would come to us in dreams here. Whereupon he awakes, arises from his sleep, he kisses the letter, breaks the seal, and reads. Lo, it is the same letter which he brought with him from on high. They gave him a letter to carry with him, but it was written in his heart, and it was the same letter. And so the comparison, it reaches up. This is like a tesseract, you see, when the two match. The two matches, a very common theme also in ancient literature, is the matching of the two parts of the tesseract. You break the tesseract, which is usually a coin of clay or metal. You cut it in two, one person keeps half, you keep the half, and when you put the two together, then it's complete. And this is the stick of Joseph and the stick of Judah, joined the very same way. Well, but he does the same thing, because it's the same letter, he matches them up, it's the same letter that was written in his heart when he brought it with him from on high. Then he remembers that he is a king's son, and his royal nature asserts itself. From this point on, everything is in reverse. It goes backwards. He now does an about face, and everything reverses. He remembers the pearl, and he has to get it, so he sets about lulling the serpent to sleep, invoking over it the name of the Father. He does it by prayer, you see. And our second, and of my mother, the queen of the east. Having seized the pearl, he does an about face, wholly drawn in one direction, we're told, toward his father's house, having at this point reached the uttermost depths when he was able to get it. First he sheds his filthy garments for cleaner ones, then he leaves them behind in the world where they belong. He sets his course undeviatingly toward the light of our home in the east. The letter that woke him also leads the way, both as a guiding voice and as a guiding light. And of course the Nahir, there were the two birds, the Hudhud and the Nasir were the two messenger birds, the guide birds that take you to the presence of Solomon, to guide you there. It was a real document written on paper or silk of high sheen with red ink. I wish I have the tangible document here. Encouraged the traveler by its guiding voice and instructions which fork of the road to follow and so forth, and drawing him on with love. He successfully passed through Sarbug and left Babylon on his left, and so he reached Mishan, the port of the merchants, where you cross the division line on the shore of the sea. There his garment and his outer robe were waiting for him there, so he could... There he had to change clothes because now he's entering the temple. See, now he's going into the new phase here. They had been sent ahead from home by his parents in the custody of the two faithful guides that had left him at that point. They're waiting for him. They have the garment ready for him. Everything is ready to resume now. He had forgotten, we thought, how glorious the clothing was, having lost his childhood memories of home. But it all came back to him. The moment he saw it, it came back to him. He saw himself as he was, as if in a mirror. He and the garment completely identified with each other, for the garment will fit nobody else but you. They're a single individual, though they were separate. He noticed the same phenomenon in the two guides that brought the garment, that there were two of them, but each bore the identical token of the king. By this sign, he also reclaimed his own inheritance, namely the garment, with the gold and the precious stones which adorned it, fastened everywhere with diamond clasps, and the image of the King of Kings covered the whole thing. And then he saw the whole thing begin to stir and set in motion. And then he gives certain signs. Before he can go any farther, he gives certain signs and tokens at the veil here. And then it tells us, I clothed myself with it and mounted up to the gate of greeting. Now he comes to the gate finally, the final home, and the whole family is there to greet him. And the first person to embrace him was the last person to embrace him as he left. It was his heavenly mother. You notice that we don't have a lot of Heavenly Mother in our teachings, because the Heavenly Mother has her particular job, which is to keep the store while the others go forth on missionaries. You notice all the angels and all the missionaries are male, because the Mother, of course, is the eternal hearth and home. She has her work to do there, and she is the last to greet him as he goes, and the first to greet him as he comes back is the Heavenly Mother. That marvelous, those marvelous lines by Sappho. Hespera panta ferae sosin... Eskenet Ios. Final Eskenet Ios. Feris Ois, Feris Aiga, Feris Dabimedri Pida. Now, the evening brings back to the mother all the creatures that the bright sun of morning had scattered around 10 a.m. Pharaoh Suish, you bring back the little sheep. Pharaoh Aiga, you bring back the little goat. So, of course, the shepherd life. Pharis, Dapi Maitri, Paita, and bring the little boy back to his mother. Everybody goes out on their bright adventures. Odysseus goes forth into the world for his 30 years of adventure and so forth, but he always wants to get home. In the end, it's his Penelope that he has in mind. It's the same thing. He goes back to home, and I say it's an interesting item here that it's the Heavenly Mother that greets him along with the Father. Well, it says here briefly, at the gate of his princes, I mingled with the great ones. This, the oldest Egyptian writing, the oldest book in the world ends with this. He gets back to heaven and mingles with the great ones there. Paramixtos heroes, as the fourth eclogue of Virgil says, I mingled with the great ones, and at the doors of the palace, which was from the beginning, I mingled among them. And he who received me joyfully, I was with him in his kingdom. And then the Kaphalaya. This is the first greeting. There are the four greetings he receives. Five greetings, isn't it? The first greeting of peace, which the gods and angels gave to the first man as he departed from the Aeon of Light. This same greeting ceremony took place with Adam, we're told, right at the beginning. The same greeting when he returned with the first man when he departed from the Aeon of Light. The second token, the second greeting of the five tokens, is the first is the greeting of the right hand, the clasp of the right hand, that which the mother of life gave to the first man when he went forth to the contest, or the mother sent him out on the contest. The first embrace, the espasmos, that's the embrace through the veil, it's so important in Egypt, is that which the mother of life gave to the first man as he separated himself from her in order to come down to the earth to be tested. For the agon, for the testing. Very interesting statement. See, he comes down here to be tested. She wishes him luck. She hopes he'll be able to carry on, and gives him the best, and covers him with love and so forth, as they embrace, as he separates in order to come down to the earth for testing. Also, all the gods and angels embraced him on that occasion, and all who were to be of the church hereafter embraced him with love. The word is espazein, which means grasp, embrace, you see. And the final verse is, the first honoring, the na'ush, the first good wish, is that which Adam received when he left for the abyss below. He bowed the knee, worshipped the God of truth and of all the eons of light. So it goes back to the process that Adam gets. Now these are remarkable documents come from the early church. I say this was discovered in 1906 and everybody accepts it as the earliest Christian document we have. It's much earlier than the others, going way back there to the first century, the middle of the first century. So the pre-existence was a very important part of the early thing, but now we got to get to cosmology. And what you should notice as we go along is the pre-existent passages in the book of Abraham, the book of Moses, so they're very clear in there. Remember, Abraham comes down the same way, thou art one of them, Abraham, thou art chosen before thou wast born, so forth.